Green's back with us today. I guess he didn't get sick of us.
No, can't get enough. You guys are awesome. Glad to be here.
You're too kind, Birdie. You're way too kind.
Between the three of us, we were thinking, well, okay, what's the good topic that we could talk? What it came down to was sales and the general a cyber practitioner. What are the things that we need to help people prepare for if they want to get into this field? And what does that potentially candidate look like? That's a mouthful.
You encompassed it, though. That was the pre-interview. I think those are good topics that go together.
Yeah, good topics, Maurice. Without sales, it's just a hobby. So you got to have sales.
Without sales, it's just a hobby. Heck yeah. Redundancy is good in this case. Let's dive into that then. What makes a great cyber practitioner?
The point that I was bringing up was the catalyst to this, is that I met with Eric's son last week, who was a new college graduate and is looking for his first role. And running into a lot of the hurdles, a lot of people are in that position, excuse me. And so what I was sharing with Britton was how much general experience that a lot of the people that I've seen be really good at cyber weren't always cyber people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit of a self-imposed hurdle people trying to get into cyber have is, how do I get into this crowd or this culture? When often those people are an assortment of different skills they gained from a ton of different jobs prior. So everything has application, like the first two episodes, if you maximize that investment of knowledge or time or money, whatever.
I met this person and she wrote a New York Times bestseller. And she was speaking about one of my friends in her book. What she said is she was the head of investment banking for this gigantic firm. And of course, you get all these applicants from Harvard, from MIT, from Yale. And you're talking from most prestigious institutions out there. She decided on a ranch hand. So my friend is a ranch hand. He would go over and do some things in Arizona for his grandpa. And what this individual said was, I can't teach work ethic. I can teach them the necessary skills, but I can't teach them work ethic. And when she saw what kind of individual this was, and he's a very successful individual himself. But to your point, that general experience, I think we often overlook it, thinking that we need to get a prestigious school instead of good old-fashioned hard work.
That's what I like about Birdie's approach to it for new cybersecurity graduates, is getting that overall experience. I know when I was young, when I was in high school, I worked on a farm and I worked with cows, and I thought, I don't want to be doing this forever. And that really got me into saying, look, I want to be serious about getting my degree and then going out into the workforce. And I never thought about going into cyber. Cyber wasn't that big of a deal when I was younger. Of course, it was there, but it was smaller. So I just went into technology. And so I think Birdie's idea of, yeah, get some well-rounded experience and kind of understand how things work, how business work, how interactions with customers work, what type of issues, how to solve problems. I think that's super important.
Birdie, was there anything that you wanted to say on that?
I guess I have an example, and this I can call someone out by name that I know will probably be very happy he's being referenced. Anthony Horn is somebody that I met through a good friend of mine, Mike Horn. And Mike is a former police detective, and he worked for Homeland. He's very a defensive mindset kind of person. And his son was being told in his roles that he's too honest. And I kept hearing this feedback that my son's being told he's too honest. And eventually I'm like, what does that mean? Says who? Give me context here. That's weird. So I ended up speaking with Anthony in the same way I spoke with Britton last week, and just understood his background. And he was at the time a bartender, before that a librarian, and before that a real estate agent. So we walked through those three different roles where he felt those were, at that time, a little bit of a waste of his time because he did something and it didn't lead to a larger thing, when in reality, we walked through what he learned in those things. So when he was a bartender, he learned to deal with all different kinds of people, sober, drunk as hell, all the different variety. And then when he was a librarian, he learned how to catalog things in his head. What was the best way to do this? Batch process, returning books. There was a lot of problem solving there. In real estate, that was pure sales. And he was often being penalized for being honest in ways that would maybe hinder his sale. But if I were the buyer, I'd want that kind of feedback. So it speaks a lot to his clientele at the time. So through those three experiences, when I said, man, you're going to be a great SOC analyst. And he felt really accomplished in that. And he went from intern to level one SOC analyst to level two leading an IR team. all it took really was a nudge and understanding that all of that time wasn't wasted. That time was really well spent if you apply it.
Listening to you talk about that made me think of one word, and that's integrity. And again, I'll use that in the term kumbayash. The things that both of you are speaking about, when they get out there and they get that experience, they understand exactly what they will and will not do. I remember when I was pursuing Ivy League, my whole thing was, I'm going Ivy League. And then I got there and it was, all right, it's an education, man. It's an education. And I found that the people that were those people that grinded it out and had those different positions and so on and so forth were the ones that really excelled. Yeah, there's trust fund kids and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the ones that I just adored were the ones that did come from a farm, a small town, or something that they really had that experience to figure out who they were instead of being defined by the process of becoming something. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. I think it doesn't matter where you go to school. You can be successful Ivy League, you can be successful non-Ivy League. It all depends. What you put into it is what you get out of it. If you go there with that attitude and you apply yourself to different things and push yourself and work on projects that you volunteer for and you want to help and you want to learn, and you take advantage of all of those smart people there, the professors, these people with all this experience, that's where you really get to learn. So what you put into it truly is what you get out of it, whether it's Ivy League, non-Ivy League, trade school. Well, we talked about trade schools with cybersecurity. That's another path for cybersecurity people looking to go into that field. So it just depends on what the person wants to get out of it, the experiences they want, and applying themselves as much as they can when they're doing that.
I've even gone as nerdy as to say it's use scientific process. If you're going to do a cert or something, put down a hypothesis, not just in your head. Here's what I think I'm going to learn. Go through it. And at the end, was it a good use of your time or not a good use of your time for learning? But either way, that was a good use of your time. But it's only if you have that, what am I hoping to learn? What can I share? There is no waste of time as long as you are thoughtful and intentional.
I'm glad you brought that up. Sometimes people forget that iteration is a good thing and they get stuck in one cycle and they stay in the cycle. I'm in finance, I'm going to stay in finance. Instead of, I'm going to venture on into sales, I'm going to venture on to marketing and those different things. So it's a self-iteration, and you can iterate even in the same position if that's your passion. But utilizing, to your point, the scientific method or something like it to get to the next level or to the next iteration of self, so important. And these are soft things that we're talking about, but they really go into play with job satisfaction and then external happiness.
It's setting expectations too, self-expectations. A lot of people will finish college and feel, oh, I'm ready to get the role. I've already proven everything I can. And some of this may be true, but set yourself up to be a winner. Something else for me too, this is how I speak to my wife about how to maybe work with me and set me up for success, is there's pass, there's fail, and there's overachieve. Allow there to be three. If it's polar and binary, it turns into you care, you don't. There needs to be three, at least.
I love that. How about you, Eric?
Yeah, a few things. One of the things I'm thinking of too is what Bertie said about sales, starting off into sales. That's something that I had done after college, and I went down to Southern California for a short time, and we had a short span of time where we were doing some seasonal type sales. It was a great time. I actually found I was really good at it, and I thought, okay, I could be a salesperson. That's what I could do. And I ended up going back and getting into technical, starting with some internet startup service provider type of capabilities. However, that experience, so I'm still dwelling on that, what Bertie said about going into sales, because you really get to see it from a different angle. You get to see why there is a business there. And then if you're thinking about going on to a technology path, you're thinking of what you have to build, and then more defined a security path, what you have to protect. But really seeing that sales part of saying, look, I have a product or a service. Here's something people might want to buy. I need to find those people. I need to qualify them. I need to find enough volume of people to talk to communicate, to start leads, and then further qualify them, and then hopefully sell some of them. So it's a numbers game, of course. And then being able to understand that. And when you get your first contract signed, you feel really good. You're like, wow, I did something. After that, you feel like, I want to make sure I get a good product delivered to this person. Then as you see how companies do this and customer satisfaction, customer success, account manager, managers, different people like that, solution architects, it really opens your eyes to the end-to-end process of once you find a customer and they're interested, and then you show them your product, you show them how it does a better overall job than the competitors, you show them how they're going to be helped during the process, and then also, of course, trying to get them to re-sign up on the contract again. I think that's a really important process for people to see. I know when I was in cybersecurity, I was in technology, I was building Linux servers, and my customer, which was internal in cybersecurity, said, hey, we want you to come over here and work in our department. So that's how I got started. I really wasn't really, security was super interesting, but it's just interesting how some people just are brought into those roles and some people want to go into them. So I really like hearing Birdie about a good path to be able to start in, because I never started into it. I mean, it's like, how does somebody really want to go into cybersecurity rather than being asked to because there's a need? So, but what I find is fascinating is that part of sales, what you said, like with some of these other experiences. And again, experiences are what differentiate humans between things like AI, because we have these experiences. We know how people feel on the other side when they're going to buy something and whether they like it or not. Those people remember those experiences. And so when they go into the next interaction, that's what a lot of their decision is based on.
Yep. Absolutely. Something I think is lacking in the sales arena, and I don't know if this is always or if it's more now. When I got started in sales, I did a lot of technical certs because I wanted to understand what I was selling, how I was selling. It felt strange to me to be very convicted that you should have my product, it'll change your world. How? They told me it would change your world and I believe them. That seems like a really weak pitch to me. And so it was really funny when I started. Drink the Kool-Aid. Yeah. The first sale is marketing and product development, selling it to the sales reps. Sale two is when customers are buying it. And I always felt it was important that I was validating things do what they say they do. This is actually going to impact your world. Let me give you context to that. But I got a lot of pushback, and I still get pushback on being a sales. I'm not a salesperson anymore, but being a salesperson who understands the technical, it turned into, you're a technical seller. That's cool. I'm a relationship seller. People would say that's, and I was like, no, I'm both. Why would I ever pick one? That seems silly to me. There's more to it than just technical win is one thing. That doesn't mean it's an actual win yet. There is more to it than that. And so I do think there is an unintentional ignorance. There it is. Where salespeople say, hey, engineer, just engineer this thing. Get me a technical win. And then the engineer saying, hey, salesperson, just close it. We don't really understand each and maybe value each other's roles all the time when there is an art to that. I do think that the new model of sales is technical sellers, is people having that understanding. And I think I am seeing that out in the world, too. That didn't used to be the case. Pure salespeople that didn't have any technical knowledge or desire for that did very well. I don't really see that as much.
One thing too is when you look at a candidate to be able to buy something, customer, prospective customer, I think that's one thing is you look at them as a prospect and then you see them in the future as a recurring customer. So it's initially gaining that new customer and then saying, okay, if I sell them something that they don't need, they're going to see it. They paid for it. They're not going to feel too good about it. Are they going to be a repeat customer again? In cybersecurity, I think that's a really important part, and especially where the CISO position has to be both technical and current with technical, and then also be able to be business as well and be able to step into one, then the other, and talk both and be current in both business as well. So understanding the customers, understanding your product, understand how it works with theirs, understand how their security model works, what's important to them, third-party security and certain things like that, but also being able to help your company sell its product and knowing how that product works, knowing how you've helped with product security, with the chief product officer, other people that are involved in developing that, whether it's secure coding practices, understanding releases to production, availability, how to have backup, disaster recovery site, all of that stuff. I think that's really a model that CISOs should be aware of the sales cycle and understand their products and be able to step from one to another. But I like that word integrity too, because really seeing that customer as an important person that you want to maintain that relationship with and repeat sales because you believe in your product. You wouldn't be working at that company if you didn't believe in your product. So you want them to benefit from it and keep purchasing it, using it.
I'll even add some nuance to that. That world has changed and there's such a higher importance on that renewal business because of SaaS. In the old model with perpetual licensing, that was like batch processing. Someone would buy 5 years of a license and then they'd be completely gone. A lot of times the way these finance models work, if you buy a SaaS product, the company loses money year one, because they have to pay the sales reps. A lot of times they're specialist reps. So anywhere from 4 to 10 people can get paid when a deal closes. Year two and beyond is when it's profitable. And so it's really important to maintain the customers now more than ever. If you get them 1 year and then lose them, you've actually hurt the company. It's not limited help. You've hurt the company.
You're right. If you look at employee retention, for instance, if you are doing a hard pitch to recruit somebody and then they're unsatisfied and then they leave, it costs almost as much, if not more, of their salary to replace that individual, because you need to get the person up to speed. It's a recruiting process and everything else like that. So there is wisdom in that, even in the sales perspective of that recurrence.
Yeah, that's a whole other topic too.
Yeah.
You lose all of that knowledge that goes out the door. You lose their relationships. You lose so much. And then you lose the momentum too. The momentum of things that they were starting to build. And then when they leave, somebody else has to figure it out. It takes them a while to figure it out and start their own momentum.
My, oh my, this is a fun little deviation of what typically cybersecurity is, because it maybe doesn't come top of mind, and the ability to sell and what that brings to the table for the company, for the individual, and the whole gamut of the people we serve.
And the way I think about it too is that if I do a good job, so if I learn holistically how my product works, the context of the client environment and the business they're in, and I can give a holistic recommendation of how my solution of any kind stacks up against competitors, that person might listen to me and just make decisions based on that. If I give them an extreme sale on what mine will do and all the others don't even touch me for some cliche reason, they're going to go and they're going to do their own analysis. Yeah. So I can make it nice and simple and use integrity, as you shared earlier, and give them my opinion and where I stack up, or give them my information and let them do their homework and go and talk to everyone else. It makes more sense to be honest to me.
Also, speaking about, I want to hear your thoughts on, with SaaS especially, in the SaaS model where customers are procuring something, then they renew every year or 3 years or whatever the term of the contract might be. But in between then, the cloud application provider is building new things and they're looking at competitors. They're looking at growing horizontally across different spaces and trying to displace other competing products, but then also trying to strengthen their product and stay current. I just want to get your thoughts on how do you, as a security practitioner, work with your company to help with that model, then also be able to speak to customers about how a company is approaching a market and saying, okay, yeah, here's our base product. Now we're building into this and we're seeing a need for this and we're building horizontally to be able to help with these other things. I know security practitioners always want a single pane of glass. But in reality, that doesn't exist. There's multiple screens and so forth. And so you want to make sure that all of those applications work within each other and they complement each other. And they're easy, most importantly, for your SOC analysts and your other security engineers to be able to use and be able to be effective with the role that they play in securing your operations. I guess the question is, how do you feel companies that are working with security, what is a good method to be able to go about that on sales strategies and security strategies?
Great question. And you're right. A lot of tech companies have their beachhead or their product that gets them in the marketplace and then they expand. Everyone wants to be a platform. Part of what I do is single pane of glass. Let's use that as an example. I know that security practitioners do not like that term because there's no such thing. No one will ever centralize into one pane. So make a little bit of fun of that. Hey, I have your POG. I know you probably have 5 SPOGs. So be a little more real with people and provide them the context where I can actually help. It's the hyperbole that I think annoys people. When you say, I'm going to change the way your SOC works. Wow, that's some really cocky shit you just said. So that's part one. An example of someone who's done this well, in my opinion, would be Proofpoint. That I think Proofpoint came up when spam and things like that were at their height. And they took care of spam and known viruses. Then they moved on to a sandbox. and they were stuck in email for a little bit. Then they found the things that were contextually relevant to their platform. Instead of just bolting on irrelevant things, they looked at email authentication and what the cross-section of email authentication and MTA-based telemetry gives them. That makes total sense to me and makes total sense to customers. And I know people who take the TAP dashboard and they put it on board presentations because they believe in that cross-section of information. So that makes sense the way they did that and applied it. I think there is a lot of bolting on because we want to compete with that market. And that's the part that's really tough for everybody. That's tough for a client who's trying to figure out what you're saying to me. That's tough for a sales rep who's saying, yeah, these things are better together. Why? Because you can buy them both from me. That's not a reason. So I think this is context, getting into understanding their point of view.
I think the Proofpoint example is a good one. That's a good company, and they know their core expertise. And so they find other parts in their core expertise that can help customers. And they just say, look, this is part of our core. Here's something else that will help you. And it complements our existing base product. And also on the inverse of that, I have seen when procuring different items to your point where there's, hey, we'll also offer this. And then you're thinking, that's not that great. But one of your other products is pretty good, but I'll continue buying from a different vendor. On the other one.
There is vendor proliferation too, right? So that's if you end up buying the onesie twosies, you end up putting together a Frankenstein. So I do recognize that there is value in a lot of these products that are pre-integrated. And I have competed in from a salesperson perspective with a lot of folks who basically say, you can use my best of class product and it has open APIs. And I'm like, great, where's your development team? Or do you have budget for a development team? How are you even going to take advantage of those open APIs? That's useless unless you're going to do something with it. So I think the reality of integrating these things together for that combined value, are you capable of doing that? And if not, it seems like a silly decision. So balance.
It's hard to get that out too, because you'll get a lot of promises. I've seen this before. It's, yeah, we're developing on this. Here's our plans. It's like, we really want to see something. And if you buy it and you're sitting there waiting, it's really super annoying. And also on the Frankenstein, I really like that word. I'm going to start using that. The reason that's interesting is on renewals, in order to entice a customer, I've seen some companies do this. They'll say, oh, now we do this other thing too. So you don't have to buy that. If you renew with us, you're going to pay the same price. Plus, we're going to save you on something else that you're already buying, and you don't have to buy that. Now we offer it. And that's when you start getting into that Frankenstein. You're saying, okay, maybe we'll take a gamble and we'll see if this works as good. And then that's when you get stuck with something that's bad and you have to wait till the contract's done or figure something out. It's really not a good place to be in.
You guys watch Archer, the TV show?
No, I've never seen it.
There's a part in Archer where if someone spills something or whatever, Archer's like, and that's how we get ants. And I feel like there should be a, that's how we get tech debt. We should redo that to making some of those short-term decisions. That's how tech debt happens.
Yeah, totally.
We have some good info here. And what I'd like to do is make sure that when the audience responds, we can delve into the topic or move on to some other things as well. But I think in this discussion here, it's been interesting to see your perspectives, because when you hear the word cybersecurity, CISO, anything related to that, I think of tech. I am happy that you folks expanded it into a realm that makes it very tangible for folks like me that weren't in that field.
Behavioral guardrails. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Eric.
That's good. Yeah, Maurice, we need to get some of the user feedback comments back into here, because I know we've got quite a few and quite a few other opportunities to look at things people want us to talk about. So we're going to have to integrate those into some of our next ones. We're starting to get some really good ideas from the user community. So that's really good. We need to keep that up.